But welcome back to our final class of Buddhist Essentials, Ethics, Concentration, and Wisdom. So occasionally I'll start with wisdom and then go through because wisdom is actually it's the linchpin. It's the most important, but it's also often the most challenging. So this time we've left it to the end, just so that we can see have some context with it. And of course, there's no way I can talk about all of Buddhist wisdom in one evening, but we're going to just have a look at wisdom from what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, and a little bit about wisdom, relative and ultimate truth, and also wisdom from a psychology point of view. So we'll have a few different goes at it. Now, what we've already covered, it's based on the three higher trainings. So these were the three higher trainings actually within Tibetan Buddhism isn't mentioned that often because they're built in to all of the practices anyway, and they're a middle scope teaching. However, having an explicit explanation about them I found really useful just so we can recognize when they show up in other places as well. So the three higher trainings, ethics, which actually creates our happiness, concentration to overcome distractions, and we're just saying, before class, in the modern world there are so many distractions and so many of them seem like fun, and then the others are that term busy work. But concentration is the thing that helps us with that, to know what direction to take. And then wisdom, which is the skill that will help us cut the very root of suffering. Because otherwise, if we don't, we're just running around. We have a problem, we try and fix the problem. We may or may not be able to. Then we have another problem. We try and fix that, but we may or may not be able to. And it's just like putting out fires all the time, continuously. So what if we didn't have to run around like that and could actually get to the root of the problem? So we have no more problems. So they're higher trainings because they lead us to not just a good worldly life, but to liberation and enlightenment. So the goal's really big. And often, with these things, we might be tempted to develop them just because we've got a problem in our life at the moment. But we've got to broaden the aim. Otherwise, once that problem's over, then we'll forget about developing these trainings and that'll be it. Okay. So, for the previous classes, was there anything that has stood out for you about either the ethics or the concentration that stayed with you over the weeks, that's been meaningful or had an impact, or even that you didn't agree with or felt uncomfortable about? And so what gives you the courage to stick to your guns with the ethics? And that's something that you've considered and you've worked out over time, and so you're happy to.
Even with things bad, we still don't change
So that takes courage to do that, to actually embody your ethics and do the things, act in that way in accord with it. And I mean, if we let our ethics slide, which I have every now and again. And you pay for that too. It takes courage. You pay for standing up for things. Often it's a shoot the messenger kind of situation. So if you're the one to actually speak up, people will blame you rather than the problem. But also not speaking up or just kind of letting it slide and then it slides more also has terrible consequences. So.
What else slides with it?
Yeah,
So let that slide, another thing
other
slide,
things, and then there's an even bigger mess. Suzanne, what about you? Anything that you've particularly liked or found useful, or Yeah, so that they have a trust in you and
Yeah,
confidence
because I
in
know
you.
their
Yeah.
homes.
Ethical, and then I suppose it'd have to be non-judgmental as well.
Yeah.
And so what we'll look at tonight with wisdom is how the training in wisdom supports all of that. It supports our ethics, so you know what's right and what's wrong. That comes from the wisdom. And the having the confidence to live by that and to live a really ethical life and to be really mindful that you're not being judgmental or you're not being kind of just what's the word when you're not blasé, but when you like neglecting people's welfare, just I feel okay, so then we neglect other, so all of that concentration or that awareness of how we're acting in the world also comes supported by wisdom. And often we start at the other direction. We start with ethics or trying to be compassionate or kind or trying to stand up for the vulnerable. But it's really easy to burn out. And the reason we burn out is because it's not supported by wisdom. Because when we're pushed, or when we are experiencing stress, we've got to have something to hold on to that we know it's worth it. And that's not the feeling, because the feeling's gone. We're stressed and we're pushed. So it's got to be something more. So it's the wisdom. You can't help as
Yeah,
much
if you recharge that.
physically. Yeah, that's
Yeah.
right. But to pull it back in and recharge and not lose the wish to help requires wisdom. If we don't have the wisdom, then we just go, I'm over this, me time, and then we forget about others. So that's one of the things that happened during the COVID lockdowns when everyone pulled back from interacting with others and helping others. That when the lockdowns finished, then nobody went out again. And volunteer organizations lost like 50% of their volunteers because nobody came back again. So it's got to be supported by something more than just a feeling or a momentum. Yes, you're absolutely right. Surrounding yourself with people that are ethical means we can kind of get into their slipstream and be inspired by them. And also being in a group, we tend to mimic the group. And I mean, that's what's so amazing about coming here, that everybody who comes here is trying to be sincere and good people. And there's just something that relaxes in me when I'm in that environment. There's something about being with others who are on the same page like that, that's like being a witness as well. There's a support.
Easy.
Yeah, it's easy. That's right. That's right. Yeah, so that was one of the main things with the ethics class, to make sure that you spend a substantial amount of time with people that are more ethical than you, so that you get lifted up. Otherwise, the whole time you're lifting other people up, which is great, but you also need some rest and recuperation then. Then we get really quite tired if we're the one. So let's do a short meditation just to focus our purpose for being here. And then we can get into the nitty-gritty of the topic. So to adjust our physical posture first, imagine that thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, coming out the crown of your head. Feel as if the weight of your body is being suspended from your crown. Let your spine naturally adjust, maybe sit a little bit further back, still keeping the curvature of the spine, but just making your posture a little bit more alert. Chin pulled back, head just slightly tilted forward, jaw relaxed. Tongue on the upper palate behind the top teeth. Slight smile on your lips. letting your eyes be just lightly closed or just a sliver of light coming in. And releasing any tension from the temples, the forehead. Then letting any tension from the neck and shoulders flow off the shoulders, releasing that tension. Hands in the lap, right palm on top of left with the thumbs lightly touching. And gently bringing your focus just to the rolling rhythm of the breath. Letting all the thoughts of the day just come to rest, just like autumn leaves come to rest when the wind stops. And think of your purpose for being here tonight. Who in your life that you wish to benefit? Who you might even be responsible for? Family and at work? And how, if we wish to benefit these people, we ourselves have to take care of ourselves. So, the areas where we need to take care for ourselves personally. And then adjusting our motivation to make sure that all the effort that we put in can benefit ourselves, everyone around us, everyone we come into contact with in our life. May we leave them happier than when we first found them. And may we be able to train in these three higher trainings so we can actually develop our potential to its utmost. In particular, liberate ourselves from all the causes of suffering by developing wisdom, and that way be able to liberate all living beings from all of the causes of their problems as well and bring them to happiness. So, with this kind of vast motivation that's also rooted right here in tonight's context, take a long deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. And we can dive right in. So, yeah, what they say about wisdom is that, a lot of the time with Buddhist psychology in particular and the understanding of how our mind works, we put in a lot of antidotes to the disturbing emotions. So antidotes to attachment and craving, antidotes to intolerance and frustration all the way to hatred, antidotes to jealousy, antidotes to resentment, antidotes to boredom, all of those things. But that takes a huge amount of effort. So what if instead of like that, putting cold water into the boiling pot over and over again, keeping on, what if we just took the pot off the boil? What if we actually removed the very root of all of those afflictive states of mind that, bring us so much suffering? So that's what wisdom is about. So the higher training in wisdom, starting with a quote from His Holiness, we are at the center of all of our troubles. It is therefore best to work at understanding our true nature first. So this is the kind of wisdom that we're going to look at isn't just the wisdom about everything. It's not the wisdom, it's not the scientific wisdom about when did the universe start or when did time start or what's the smallest particle in the world or anything like that. It's actually about the nature of reality and in particular our reality because it's our experience. So I really like this. Like I said in the very first class, rather than starting with an abstract theory, which can be infinitely interesting, by the way, but we really got to start with ourselves and have it like applied wisdom. Start with ourselves because it's ourselves that suffer. It's ourselves that we want to be free. And also because the kindness and compassion isn't enough. It's not enough to become free. We need an understanding to support it. And so, looking at our true nature, well, oh my gosh, I'm going to come at it from a few different angles tonight. So, first, to set the scene, where do we start? And so, we start by a general kind of understanding. This is also from His Holiness. All phenomena arise by the collection of many conditions together. Because of the collection of many conditions, there is no inherence. So, all phenomena, everything that we experience and ourselves included, aren't just one thing or one essence, but a collection of many things coming together. And all of those are changing all of the time. And because of that, there's no inherence or there's no ultimate essence. So there's a general thing going on, but there's no ultimate essence. Now, what happens is that we confuse the dual nature of reality. We confuse relative and ultimate. And because of this, it creates enormous suffering for ourselves. So we have this feeling that there's this real me in here. And it's not even something we have to think about. It's a feeling because, when someone goes to hit you recoil, you protect. And I know when I'm upset, I feel it here physically in my heart. When someone accuses you of something or calls you a horrible name, you feel it. It hurts you. You feel like there's a real me in here being hurt. So that feeling is, it's a valid feeling, but it doesn't tell us the truth. And this is the problem. So because that feeling is so intense, we think that's the real me. There's a real ultimate me in there that's, the essence of me. And then from that, of course, then we need to defend it and so on, which we'll go into. So when we think about this, we might be tempted to go all the way to the other side and that go, therefore, there is no me. And that's not right either. There is a me, but it's a relative me. So we get them mixed up. The who we think we are, it is there, but certainly not in that ultimate way. And we can also apply this to phenomena, so to everything around us as well, problems and people and situations, that they don't exist in the way they first appear either. They don't, even though they look like exactly how they look like, and that's it, and that's what they are, or how we understand them. Just as when we first meet someone and then we get to know them a bit better, how they appear to our mind changes because we get the person's backstory. We get to understand where they're coming from, their point of view. We might become a little bit more tolerant as we find out the backstory. So, again, people don't exist in the way that they first appear. So, really, at the moment, what we're doing is making lots of assumptions about reality without even knowing it and putting on a whole lot more of a story than is actually there. And that might go along fine for a while until bam, we hit up against reality. And someone acts differently from what we expect, for instance, or we start feeling really intimidated and lash out because we're protecting this I that doesn't even exist in that way. Or we get so incredibly demoralized because we think things are in a particular way and we hate it. And because we think they exist ultimately like that, then there's no possibility in our mind that they might be able to change. So when we say things or problems don't exist in the way that they first appear, it's not like a visual appearance, but it's how we feel actually, how they appear to our mind or our heart. How we feel they are isn't necessarily how they are. And the stronger the feeling, the more we think it is like it appears. So the more upset we are, the more absolutely certain we are that we're right. Or the more we dislike someone, the more absolutely certain we are that they're wrong. Or the more upset we are, the more absolutely certain that there's no hope. And then if the weather's nice, we have a nice meal, or we watch some nice distracting TV or something, or we listen to some great music, all great things to distract us from the problem, and our mood changes, then we think, oh, it's not so bad after all. We have a good night's sleep. That's right. We get enough sleep. Finally, we get enough sleep. All of those things. Yeah. But then we don't remember back. We don't put it together and go, oh, one way, yesterday I thought it was like this, and today I thought it was like, we just, however it appears, we think that's it ultimately. And it creates a huge amount of problems. So one of the things to remember, of course, is that that things do change, and it appears bad or it feels bad, and that feeling is painful, but it's not necessarily telling us the truth. So we can't extrapolate more truths from it because it's incorrect. So there's a couple of, I really fall back on cliches. There's a couple of cliches that help illustrate this point. So one is, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. It's so good. I mean, it's a cliche, but actually, it's stuck around because it works. So yes, lemons, absolutely horrible, disgusting. There is no hope. However, if we can loosen our view and think, well, it's not inherently like that. There's a collection of many conditions. If we just change a few conditions, we can use this, we can benefit. The other thing about problems don't exist in the way they first appear, the other cliche is don't believe the hype. So it's our hype, we're making the hype, and we believe it. The more upset we are, the more attached we are, we believe it. So I've got this picture here to illustrate it. So, as an example, to try and illustrate, because it's a great kind of exercise of the power of context. When we have a context, things appear one way, and when we take the context away, things appear in another way. So, what are we actually seeing here in this picture? What is it? I mean, it's probably keyboard keys, laptop keys, or something, buttons. There's a horizon. There's either really badly rendered grass or a really accurately rendered RSL carpet. And I can't quite tell which one it is, but it's there. And then maybe blue sky or something or other. Yep. So, we're not disputing that and how it appears. We just think, oh, yeah, there's no problem. A and B. Different colors, whatever. So now the thing is, one way you can do it is you can just put your close one eye and put your finger over the horizon line. So, or I can do it on the laptop, which is that. And now, oh my gosh,
It's the shadow.
they're the same color. They're the same color. So then, take it back again. You put the context, you've got a context, this and that, a dualistic context, and how we see the entire reality is one way, is black and white. And then, so I like watching this, how it comes, like when does it actually change? So it's like, hang on a second, one way, grey, and then. So this is a thing that when we are looking at the whole diversity of everything, all the context, we can know that it's grey, but it doesn't change what we're seeing. What we're seeing is two different coloured keys here, two different coloured buttons. And so this is the thing about you can have the appearance, but you don't have to believe the appearance. So we can know, oh yeah, oops, wrong way. It's a relative thing. And so when we are taking the context out and looking at the big picture, that is similar to like when we're thinking about, well, what do we all have in common? What we all have in common, we're human beings. And so we have what human beings have in common, which is all the problems that come with having a body. Like, no one likes to get the flu. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, no one likes it. We all get miserable. Whether we're a man or a woman, all of those differences and how we experience life differently, when we take it to what we have in common, we're all humans. That's our common humanity. Then we put in all of the context, the different life circumstances, and then there's differences. So whether you're brought up rich or poor, there's a big difference. Whether you're brought up male or female or trans or not, when you want it to be, makes a big difference. And you can't say then we're all the same. And actually saying we're all the same in that context is kind of a bit disingenuous because it's not a level playing field. And so it doesn't take care of the vulnerable. So I remember there's this fantastic quote from James Baldwin, the famous black writer who American who went to live in France for a long time. And he said, "I am black only so long as you consider yourself white." That's really quite something. So the differences, we make the differences. But it's really hard. You look at this and you go, it appears there's differences. It appears in this particular way, but I know it's not. It doesn't change the appearance. And it's really hard to remember that it's not. You have to do an exercise, like put your finger across. And then you go, oh yeah, that's right. So when we do meditations, meditating on emptiness, that's what we're doing. We're taking away all of the diversity and just focusing on what do we have in common? What's the ultimate truth? And then you come up from your meditation session, and then you're back to all of the wonderful, array of human beings and human experience. And then it's back to all the difference again. But it's got to be informed by this underlying recognition that there are some things we all have in common, and that's really what matters. So today I learned a new term, dualistic substantialism. And that's pretty much what it is where you think that each one of these is a separate thing existing in its own right. But really, what we're seeing is they're the same entity, they're just different ways of looking at it. So we can't ignore the relative because then we become really insensitive to the vulnerable or we disadvantage others. And we can't ignore the ultimate because then we become really polarized. It's easy to become polarized. Us and them. When we focus on difference, often we get really polarized, and then start feeling fearful. Tried to think of another example today, and the one that came to me was just this example of, the serenity prayer to know to to know what I can change, what I can't change, and to be able to tell the difference. And really, to know that we need wisdom. We need wisdom to be able to work it out. Okay, so that's our little bit of fun for the day. So next time I fall down on the RSL floor, I'm going to be thinking about these buttons. What this wisdom, what our wisdom, realizing the nature of our reality, and it's actually called the wisdom realizing emptiness. What it cuts the source of all of our confusion and problems, and where we can really focus it is on our identity. So our mistake, we think there's a real concrete findable me, this is me, but actually under investigation, like if we really start investigating, it might appear, oh, this is me, but under investigating, no one has ever discovered an independent self. No one's ever discovered a non-changing self. No one's ever discovered a me separate from body and mind. It feels like it's there, but so far never been discovered. So there's a mistake being made, and what's being made is this confusion about the confusion about our identity, and because of that, these three major disturbances of our personal world arise: confusion, hostility, and craving. So we have this mistaken self-image, this is me, and it's pretty much based on a feeling, and not just afflictive emotions, which are the really obvious ones that we recognize, but there is a feeling that underlies us all the time. And it's this feeling of a real me. So it's something that we're not even necessarily aware of, but it's there really instinctually. And we only know it when we become distressed, when we become overly excited, when our life is threatened. Sometimes we recognize it's there when we're bored. We kind of feel this kind of inner agitation or boredom. But this feeling of a real me, it's really deep. It's instinctually deep. It's why we go into shock when our physical body is, has an accident or something. It's also why we go into shock when we have an emotional upset. So this, there's the instinctual feeling of a real me, and then when it's threatened, then we grasp at it. We just grasp at it like a drowning person. And because of that, then we have hostility to anybody who's threatening us or our identity. And we have craving for everyone that we think can build us up or fill the whole black hole of need that happens to be in there. So everything comes out of this. So we become acutely sensitive. We react with hostility towards anything that causes us pain or harms our pride. And we react with longing desire for anything that gives us pleasure or enhances our pride. And so then, without even knowing it, all of our sense of self and all of our entertainment from life suddenly now is coming from outside of us. Even though we feel there's a real me in there, we need to bolster it up constantly. We have continuous craving, continuous confusion and boredom, and continuous hostility to anyone who gets us wrong or calls us a name or does any of those things, like it hits and it hurts. So, does it make sense so far? What are your thoughts? Yeah, so I mean, that kind of gives us an indication. There's some people we're more comfortable with where we don't have to present ourselves. Then, like at work, that's why there's more tension and status anxiety at work, because we're constantly presenting ourselves as something. And even if everyone believes us, then we have like imposter syndrome. We think, oh my God, I'm going to be f found out I'm not really that good after all. Yeah, well, that's, yeah, trying to be yourself all the time, to be actually an authentic human being. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I've come a really circuitous route because I've had no idea who I was. So I tried on all these different personalities and identities. And I can remember one time on the bus, it was a long bus ride, and I was thinking, I wonder if I'm gay. And so I was like, I traced back, I was like maybe in my mid-20s, and I traced back all the way back to like early teens, and I could put the case. Yes, absolutely. All the signs point to the fact I'm gay. Oh, wow, how amazing. And then I thought, hang on a second. And then I traced all the way back through my life to my early teens of being absolutely straight and liking boys. I'm like, yeah, that's right. That's right. I get it. And I'm like, well, who the heck am I? Like, it really depends which story I'm going to look at. And it blew my mind because it swam into my mind that it depends on you framing your story. Like, so I've got to frame a story that's going to help me. I'm not going to frame a story that I'm going to blame somebody else or that I'm going to get kudos from. I don't want to be beholden to anybody else. I've got to and frame my life in a way that's going to be the most beneficial and is going to work the most. So then I create an identity, unsure. Going to just see how it goes. And so what it meant was I could be comfortable with everybody. So that was really good because I could feel completely comfortable in all the amazing gay nightclubs that were in existence in Brisbane at the time, and it's probably the only kind of alternative scene that was happening. So if you weren't comfortable in those nightclubs, you didn't have anywhere to go. So there was all of that, and then I could also feel completely comfortable in being straight. So that flexibility means that you can be open to everyone. And so then also, if we need to put on an identity, like if you go to work and say, especially if you're in a position of looking after people, you have to put on an identity that you know what you're doing and you can look after them. Like if you're seeing a nurse or a doctor, you don't want to see someone that's like going through deep self-doubt and says, I have no idea what's going on. It's like, I'm out of here. So you want to be able to put on an identity, and also say as a parent, sometimes you have to model, it's going to be okay, I'll look after you, even when inside you're just freaking out going, I don't know what's going to happen. So you have to be able to put on an identity and figure it out that, yeah, this isn't the real me, but it's okay. It's still valid. It's got some basis in reality. It's not the real me. It's coming together through causes and conditions. A lot of it's through sheer willpower and love and concern for others. And then not worry, oh, it's not true, it's fake. Because most of our identities are not true and fake. So this one, if it's there motivated by care and concern, then it will work. So yes, I'm still trying to figure out who am I really. So am I really an SPC at Lungri Tumpa Centre? Am I really like someone who can lead a class? Or am I actually, am I really someone going through a complete, nervous breakdown identity crisis and have no idea what's going on? So again, it's like it depends how you frame it. So all of those things are like the context. Just paddling along, that's right, just paddling along. So actually, then you come back and you take all of that difference away to just go, well, we're living beings. We're living beings, we have feelings, therefore we matter, and most of us don't know what the heck is going on. Yeah, that's right. We like the other person's life because we're seeing it appears so fantastic, and we can see how sucked in we get to this because in our social media, like the influencer culture, it's all about appearance, but it's posing that appearance as being an ultimate truth. If I look perfect, therefore I am perfect, therefore I am happy. And that equation does not add up. And right there we can see the cause, not just of like suffering for influences later on where they're no longer influencing, but also suffering for everyone that falls for it. But it shows why we fall for it is because we have this believing appearances so deeply in our core. It's real tragedy, that's right. So I stopped kind of feeling really intolerant towards influences and start feeling really sad and kind of concerned for to put all that effort into something that's really not going to bring you the happiness.
They're like models, I think.
Yeah, that's right, like models.
Models grasping
Keep grasping at it, but it's kind of worse because an influencer is different from a model because an influencer then gives advice. And
for
now that has major consequences. Yeah, we really dodged a bullet growing up in a in feeding both worlds, in a online world and an offline world, both. We have a chance. So here's a couple of things of how to break it down. So okay, so we have an I, we have a me, and really, what the me is made up of from a Buddhist point of view is a collection of a body and a mind. So you have a body and a mind, and that collection, then we put the name I onto it or me onto it. And so how those that body and mind come together, it all depends. It's quite circumstantial. So we have the physical causes and conditions of a body. So it's the DNA, the sperm and the egg. And so we go, okay, absolutely, that's the causes and conditions of a body. But even then, when you start looking into it, you'd think our DNA, what if we're adopted, for instance, our DNA is different from our parents. So our whole physicality, we can either take that as a problem or we can take that as a no, my parents are my parents because they grew me up and loved me. But if we think we are only our DNA, we're going to feel we're going to feel really, if we find out we're adopted, we're going to feel betrayed or alone or all of those things. Or if you've got IVF, there's even cases, really weird cases of DNA where a mother's own DNA, I can't quite remember the specifics, but her children didn't have her DNA because her own body cannibalized her own DNA. And so she was accused of stealing someone else's children and whatever, and then they did a DNA test, no DNA in common, all of this huge suffering that came out of it. And then they figured out there's this really weird condition where her DNA is hidden within this other DNA in her body. So there's always like the exception that proves the rule, but it's never 100%. And of course, you look at our DNA's got DNA from all sorts of different animals and species and everything from evolution. So it is very, it's a mixed bag. We share it with so many other species, our DNA. Then our body's made up of parts. So we have the general idea, okay, this is my body. But, it's a general thing, it's not specific. Because if you think all of my body is me, then when I watch those shows in Botched, when they cut off a piece, and it just blows my mind because it's like, it's them, it's them, it's them, it's them, not them. And it's like the black and white buttons. It's like, here's a piece of stomach and it's me, it's me. And then in the cutting, suddenly it's not me, it's on the floor. Like, what? When did the change happen? Also, with the parts, we can have extra parts on there. You can have an extra finger or you can have less fingers. So which parts are me? Then we have organ transplants. So does that mean now I'm two people if I've somebody else's organ? All of these questions come up, and a whole lot of excellent horror movies come out of it. But the questions are valid because whereabouts is this? Is it all of the body? Is it just one part of the body? So the Egyptians thought the part of the body that was you was the liver. So my friends did a show where they took all of the songs about love that mentioned the word heart and just changed it to liver. So they had Total Eclipse of the Liver and other favorites. So it really depends again with the parts. And then what we've then also gender depends not just on the various organs, but it depends on endocrine system, so subtle parts. There's a whole spectrum of being of gender. So when we look at the body, actually, which toilet we go and use, the ladies or the gents or the disabled unisex toilet, it depends on actually mere name. So it's how you identify in the end. Because all of these things, the parts and the causes and conditions, are changeable. You can't actually pin it down. So, imputation of our body, of who we are. So, for instance, also how old we feel doesn't necessarily correspond to how old our body is. And if you are raised, say if you're born Aboriginal and you're raised white, or if you're raised black, makes a huge difference. And the biggest difference is how you identify. So if you're born Aboriginal but raised in a white culture and think you're a whitey, that's going to completely change how you feel about yourself and how other people, treat you. So one of my friends who looks completely white and has freckles and thought she had an Irish background and that was it, and her grandparents were incredibly racist. Her parents weren't. And then she found out, oh, there's this secret Aboriginal member of the family, and that's of course why the grandparents were so racist that no one ever said. And so here she was thinking she was this kind of white Irish lass, and now she finds out, hang on a second, no. So, but of course, how she's been identifying is how she identifies. And on the other side, I mean, in Australia, there's so many Aborigines that just look white, and everyone goes, no, you're not. It's like, no, excuse me, I was brought up Aborigine and I most certainly am. So how, we can make a general distinction, but not a specific one. Once we start looking, we can't find any rule in there. There's always exceptions. So that's what's called the selflessness part, that you can't find a real identifiable thing. There's a general thing, but you can't find a real identifiable one. And so what you can say is that, say, age does exist, but not inherently, or gender does exist, but not inherently. Or, race does exist, but not inherently. It all depends. So that can be incredibly liberating to know that, and it can help work your way through. So, questions, comments before we get on to the tricky bit? So, I mean, even say with the parts of the body, the World Athletics Federation, they have a terrible time trying to define gender because it cannot be defined. There is no way you can pinpoint what gender is. And so the Athletics Foundation, the World Athletics, do not have a definition of what gender is. They have a committee that's made up of like 12 different people that confer on a case-by-case basis to decide, because it just can't be found. And the more you look, the less it can be found. All you can find is generalities. And really what it comes down to is the label of what everybody decides this is it for now. So the same with our mind. So our mind, many causes and conditions. There's the whole debate, is it nature or nurture? What influences us? Is it one or the other? Well, there's a red herring right there, because one or the other is that could actually be both. Usually is both. Yeah. The moment we start wanting to go one or the other, that's that dualistic thinking again, and it's a big red flag. So our brain chemistry changes all the time with just a good night's sleep, a sugar hit, all of those things, as we know. But also we can change our brain chemistry by meditating, by focusing our attention. We can actually physically change our brain. Oh, yeah, just changing the conditions. Get off social media, and that changes everybody's level of self-esteem just by one really simple thing. You don't even have to concentrate. And over and over again. Yeah, that's right. Get off social media. Yes. So get off social media as a daily thing to give yourself some space to calm down and stop with all of the at night, so you can sleep. And also, but just the influence of all of that negativity and hate and all that pressure to conform or to look fantastic, to just give yourself a break from that. But get off altogether, yes.
Well, I found when I was on it,
So that's like the relief from the constant distraction. That's just like having everyone in your head going rah, 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 just the relief from that. So, right. So short-term memory better, remember people's
Like it
names.
is better, like numbers.
Yeah, well, the various neuroscientists, people say it does change your brain. And really, the most telling thing is all the kids of people that work on at Google and all of those places don't let their kids on social media. So
Yeah, so it doesn't work.
that's my deciding point. So yeah, many causes and conditions to affect our mind. So none of those things are our mind. There's no inherence in them. So we can't say I'm one thing or another. We can't say, oh, I'm my brain chemistry, for instance. We can't say that I'm these feelings or those feelings, because we just change one of those things and we change. So there's no inherence in that. But it has a huge effect on us. And because it does, then we think it is real. On a deeper level, we have the various parts of our mind. So we have the roles that we take on. And we can really identify with those. And when we do, like if we have a role as a first responder, we may actually feel like we are strong and helpful and whatever. And then we go home and we're just in our own little environment, and then we fall apart because we're not identifying with that role anymore. On a longer term, you can have a role as a parent, and then the empty nest syndrome, of so identifying with that and needing that kind of response to feel of who you are. Then the people go, then now who am I? And instead of going, wow, the space of possibility has opened up, it's a terrifying feeling. And that's the tragedy, that it doesn't have to be a terrifying feeling, because there is no inherence. Now you can have a whole different thing that you identify with. But if you think that was you and now it's gone, it's a crisis. It doesn't have to be a crisis. So any role that you really identify strongly with, or that's been incredibly powerful, when it changes or when it goes, often it's a really traumatic event, because you've been grasping that as me. Same as if you grasp at your body as you, and say, like women who have to have their breasts removed for breast cancer, then they're gone. Now suddenly I'm no longer a woman. So they're grasping at the inherence when things change causes a huge amount of suffering. So for the mind, then also a mere name. So with artists, artists at the time that they're alive are usually just counted as really eccentric and a waste. Then when they die, suddenly they're an artist. And what they did was amazing. But again, it all depends because we took one of the Geshes to the gallery to look at all these famous pictures. And because he didn't have a Western education of art, he looked at these pictures and just went, oh.
Yeah,
Not interested, didn't get it. Now, Geshes are highly educated, amazingly intelligent. So it wasn't anything to do with that, but it's context as well, and it's how it's named and the importance that we give to it. So it really is how we frame things. That's what it comes down to. So again, how we feel about ourselves, it's how we frame it to ourselves. And once we realize that it changes, then we can relax because when it changes, it's not a crisis. Well, the way that we can adapt is by relaxing, and how we can relax is to realize that that change isn't like dissolving me because that me was never really there anyway. So there is a change and there's the turmoil of a change, but it can be really good and you can look forward to it and it can bring about something better. But if you thought it was really me, then you just collapse in a heap and think it's all over and get depressed. And then all of that comes cycling. Then you believe the depression and so on. So my ex-husband years ago, he grew up driving like in New Zealand from about the age of 12 or 13. And when I met him, he was about 38. And soon after that, he smashed his car, and it was the first time in his life that he couldn't drive. And he basically had a nervous breakdown because he lost his independence and he did not know how to live life. And so his whole sense of self disappeared. It had been entirely reliant on those conditions. And he had a complete crisis. But it was lucky that we'd just met because I grew up a pedestrian. I was able to show this whole nother way that you can live life. But I was really shocked by how you can lose your sense of self and worth by just losing your car. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, if it's all tied up in that, because the thing is, all of these things will change. They will change. So being resilient is about recognizing underneath, it's flexible. And there is this selflessness of I. So then the question comes up, so who am I really? Who am I then? If I'm not any of those things, then who am I? So one of the things, the way we feel is not the way that we are. We feel independent, permanent, substantial. We feel all of those things, but that's the mistake. So that's like the buttons. We see the buttons, but it's a mistake. And so Lama Yeshe says, well, how do I interpret myself right now? This is how we bring it into applied wisdom. So how we like to present ourselves, how we feel we really are, all of these things we can think as an interpretation of ourself. How do we interpret ourselves? And when we're thinking about this, again, don't mix up the ultimate and the conventional. So here's the crux of it. A conventional dependent arising self does exist. You know what your job is, you, Suzanne, Tina, online, Hannah, and other people. Yes, that self does exist, and it's a movable feast. An ultimate me does not exist. So the conventional dependent arising self that does exist is the one that changes all the time, that depends on causes and conditions, on the circumstances, on everything coming together, and on how we interpret it, mostly on how we interpret it. And so then how do we interpret ourselves right now? So maybe how we interpret ourselves is how other people call us. When we were kids, you know, how other people called us, how they interpreted us made all the difference. How we interpret ourselves now, whether we think, oh, I'm ugly, I'm bad, I'm stupid, I'm fat, I'm old. What's the other one? Fat, old, ugly. That's right. So, I mean, I always take issue with those three things, as if those three things are bad, right? Fat, old, and ugly. None of those three things are bad. So it's a double whammy. But even if we were those three things, it's an interpretation, what we put on, what that means. Or we have, oh, I'm stupid, I can never learn. Or I'll never be able to do those things that other people do. Or we might have the whole other thing, I can do anything. Or I can do anything I set my mind to. Or you can be whoever you want to be. So which way that we think changes how we live our whole life. And none of those are actually true. So I remember one of Eddie's cousins or his brother, when he grew up, he was always told that he was ugly. And so he determined whenever he, you know, when he had kids, he'd never call his kids ugly. So then he had kids, and so he always called his kids, you know, look, you look beautiful, look great. And then the kids are like, when they grew up, Dad, you never said I was smart. You just said I look good. No. So you just can't win, can you? But it really is in the interpretation of ourselves. So our resilience comes from recognizing who we are is a dependent arising. It does exist, but not inherently. So if we can recognize that it changes and it depends, then we can be naturally confident, because we're not frightened all the time, everything's going to change. We can be realistic. We keep our energy. We're kind of much more adaptive. Whereas if we're going, no, this is me, I'm going to make it true. Everybody has to believe me. Everyone has to like me all the time and tell me I look fantastic all the time, and all of those things that then comes to its head on the social media, where you have to have the good response. Ironically, the response, the result is getting more and more paranoid and anxious. And then everybody has the great response, and then it just lasts for a second, and now you've got to do it again. Or then you start wondering, but do they really like me? You know, it just gets worse and worse. Yeah, that's, yeah. So there's a status of having so many friends on social media. But if that's what you're relying on, that number has to grow. Because there's no magic number. You can go, oh, 25,000, it's enough. It's never enough. It's got to be a growing thing. And why it's a growing thing is it's because it's not actually feeding that sense of contentment. It's feeding the grasping at this is who I am. So the grasping just gets more. So you just need more and more and more. And if the numbers start going down eventually, then it's more catastrophic than if you had no friends. What was really good in all the various studies is that people only have, like, actually, normally people have 3 or 4 close friends and maybe 10 friends. And that's the norm. But who knew? And that's right, Tina, really in life, that's all you can handle, imagine. Yes, all that time and emotional availability, and also really think about people and what they're going through and put it together. And yeah, so it's like the movies. And again, here's another thing with the movies. So me and Eddie just went and saw this great movie last night, Sinners. So it's a genre bending horror movie. So it's not really horror. It's horror instead of just like gore, it's horror with feeling, with emotion in it and meaning. It's also got fantastic music, really good music. And so it's great. There's a few jump scares in it, of course. And so you get the popcorn out of the thing experience. So that's why we go, isn't it? To have this whole, and you know it's not true, but at the same time, if you're really involved, it is true. And then the way to like cool it down is you bring yourself back to the theater and look around and go, not looking, not looking, not looking, you know. So it's a little bit like, again, those two buttons. You're there, and then you calm yourself down a bit. So really, this is what we can do in life. In life, we experience it like a movie. We should try and remember it's like a movie. It appears in one way. We have this huge effect, but it's not really that. And like Lama Yeshe was saying about how do I interpret myself right now? What kind of movie are we playing in our own mind? What's the movie that we're playing of our life? And really, we can change it. Here's a couple of other things I just threw in. The cognitive fusion. So this is another way to deal with how that whole problem of how things appear, believing that's how they exist. So cognitive fusion is where you fuse the reality with the thing. You think it exists exactly how it appears. So fusing the behavior with the person. So if you're at the supermarket and you see a kid doing this, then you may think a whole lot of things, depending how long they've been yelling for. So if it's a kid a bit more, we might be a bit more forgiving. But if it's a person acting badly, yelling and screaming at supermarket, we just think bad person, we recoil, we get frightened. Very rarely would we think, dear person undergoing suffering, because we just relate with the appearance. And then because we often just mirror an appearance, the first thing we'll do is get aggro back. And that actually might work sometimes to make sure worse things don't happen. But with a child, we go, a bad child or a suffering child, or because in childcare, early childcare, they'll say there is no such thing as bad child. They're just all suffering children trying to let you know something's wrong. Same with adults. Here's how we can interpret it instead. It's a potential Buddha screaming to become free. So, how do I interpret myself right now? How do I interpret the environment right now? Okay, a potential Buddha screaming to be free. Doesn't necessarily mean they know how the heck to go about it, but it's a much nicer, I see you both smiling, it's much nicer interpretation, isn't it? The interpretation changes everything. So that's cognitive fusion. Bad behavior equals bad person. It's a fusion and it's a mistake. It's not a suffering person. Angry behavior equals angry person. Actually, what we've got to think is angry behavior, suffering person. See the suffering person under the angry face. There's a couple of other ones. Cognitive deficit. So, in a difficult situation, we're blind to any benefits, so cannot change. So, is anyone frightened of the dentist? No? No.
Was a dental nurse for many, many years.
Oh, okay. So you would
So,
have come across many people who are frightened
yeah,
of the
culture,
dentist. Right. So what did you say as a dental nurse to calm people down? With children.
Yeah, well,
Oh
you die, I'll kill you.
my
But
gosh, yeah, so that's children would have a massive cognitive deficit about it. So absolutely no, don't want to go, don't want to do anything. So yeah, so frightened of the noise, which has a huge effect on everyone actually, means you can't focus on the benefit. And so of course the problem with adults is that then we just leave it so long because of that. So we can't focus on the benefit of going to the dentist because the fear outweighs it. And because we think the fear is true, because it's that strong feeling. So that's that grasping and adherence again. Here's another one. Cognitive hyperactivity. In a pleasant situation, we overestimate the enjoyment and forget the consequences. So I had these couple of girls came for a few classes and one of these balancing emotions courses, and they'd come because someone who'd be coming here knew that they were pretty much alcoholics. And they were going to go off to Woodford or somewhere or other, some like how many days long festival, and he was really worried about their well-being. So he said, go to these classes and figure out how to do it well. And so I was just saying to them, so when you get drunk and you hit the sweet spot, then stop drinking. Like that's it. So don't just drink to get obliterated, but this is what happens. When we hit the sweet spot, we just go on past it, don't we? Because we think, okay, one, not there yet. Two, yep, maybe 2.5 drinks, perfect. Therefore, 3.5 drinks, extra perfect. 4.5 drinks, extra, extra perfect. It just doesn't work that way. But in the heat of the moment, I don't remember that. Anyway, they came along to quite a few classes, and so they were going, yeah, we've got this whole new way of doing Woodford or whatever it is. We're going to be fine. So who knows? But
Never. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't see them, but they came along a few times, so they must have been interested enough in it. And I wasn't going to say don't drink because also, in moderation it can be really helpful. You're either there completely clammed up, feeling terrible, or you can just relax a bit. The only time that it gets unhelpful is because we can't stop. And we can't stop because of cognitive hyperactivity, thinking the happiness is in the drink. And that's the problem. Therefore, more drink, more happiness. So it seems obvious, but it's really hard to do in practice because of the feeling. And the feeling is there. Because this grasping and adherence is so deep within us. And the only way that we can overcome it is by consciously educating ourselves. So, this is the solutions. We've got to over and over again remind ourselves of this discrepancy between appearance and reality until that becomes a habit. Because it's not going to come naturally. What comes naturally is believing the appearances. And then, hey kids, remember, don't do cognitive fusion. So that's a line from Corey Jackson. I've stolen that from Corey Jackson. He'll be here next Tuesday, and he's got a lot to say about this. And yeah, I found that really a helpful sentence to grab onto. As we become more familiar with this, we've got to aim for it to become an automatic kind of conversation that we have in our mind to automatically question things. And then after a while, just like seeing those two buttons, then after a while, it'll become a habit to remember, oh, yeah, it appears like this, doesn't exist like this for everything. So, yeah, work on your own mind first rather than an abstract philosophy. What we're trying to develop, wisdom of selflessness, no inherent self. And then there are a few little things about re-education. So one of these I put in was that we live in what's called a post-truth world where there's so much information, how can you tell what's right, what's incorrect? You can find something to prove or bolster up whatever opinion you and we gravitate towards anything that aligns with our own beliefs. So this is a tricky part to do with social media, because when it used to be newspapers, you could have a whole spread of opinions and it's all there in front of you, whether you chose to read it or not, but it was there. But online, you just get sucked into this hole where it's just what you believe in. So it's really difficult to figure out if it's true or not. Yeah, a lot of it's negative because that's the algorithm, because that's what we are the most attracted to, and what galvanizes us to continue is rage out of all the emotions, rage even more than attachment. So we've got to consciously work against that, that if we come across something that we don't like, don't necessarily recoil from it. Because this is this habit that happens with any when we get our information from social media. Oh, I don't like that explanation. I'm going to go with this one. But actually, as you find, like with Buddhist teachings, some things that you hear are incredibly relieving, and it's just like, oh, fantastic. I always thought that that makes sense. I get it. Or the teachings on compassion and love. But then other teachings are really challenging, and you go, oh, I don't like that. You put it aside. And it's a really bad habit because you need the whole lot. Of course, check your sources and how to tell what to believe in, what to take on board. Check if it is it a reputable source? Are there people that are living with that and it's proving out to be true? Is it logical? And does it, and reasonable? And does it accord with your own experience? So, with all of those, when we're educating ourselves, we have to retrain our thinking and our feeling, both of those things, because we're a fairly educated society, and just retraining our thinking, it doesn't work. Because people can be really educated and fall into incredibly fundamentalist and biased views, and be well-educated people. I'm like, how can they do that? And it's because we have to retrain our feeling as well. That's tricky. And so that's why I put this fun little picture of a kitty's house up there. Because when you first start drawing houses as a kid, I mean, that's a pretty good one. I remember when I first started drawing houses as a kid, I'd see the house and then I'd draw the crappiest drawing. And my chimneys, they all came out like that. They didn't go up. It took me ages to figure out, oh, you put them at an angle on the So when you first start trying to retrain your feeling, it feels like that. You feel really clunky and stupid. Like everything's really basic. But after a while, as you actually train, just like as your drawing can get better, or you end up drawing cartoons, or maybe some people even end up drawing blueprints and becoming architects, you can become really skilled at this. But it takes effort to do. So don't get put off that in our first little steps of retraining ourselves. It feels a bit clunky. So actually the Buddhist definition of a realization, when you change your mind, let me see if I can remember this, is it's an experiential awareness from an inferential cognition. That's what a realization is, an experiential awareness from an inferential cognition. So that means that it's something we experience. So it's not just an academic thing. And it's a new awareness. So we're fully engaged with it and we understand, but it's an experience. And it comes from thinking, from inferring things and putting things together that aren't obvious. So, an inferential cognition. So, that's what a realization is, that you put things together differently in a different way from effort, and it changes your whole experience. And so, you know, you have realizations when you go out into the world and you respond differently. That's the evidence of it. You don't get road rage the same, or like Suzanne, you were saying, you feel more relaxed. You're driving from here, there, and everywhere, and you're not stressed. So that's because things are changing. So that's like the feeling of that comes from being in a more calm environment. But the actual awareness and the change in like the very DNA of us comes from the wisdom. It's supported by the wisdom. And so then when things go pear-shaped and you respond completely differently, it's not something that you're forcing yourself to be nice, and it's not unstable. It's something that you've actually changed. So that's where the wisdom's taking us to. So we use words to reframe our reality. And, last resort, you just ask yourself, what would the Dalai Lama say? That's a really good go-to. Like, how am I going to frame this reality? How am I going to interpret myself? Well, what would His Holiness say? It's such a big topic, how to get started. This is where I thought these are some things that are little bite-sized pieces to. Oh, brain stretch. That's good. That's good. Excellent. So just let it slowly come in. Let everything settle. Very good. Yes. So our wisdom actually, it recognizes our connection with others. It supports that connection. It supports all of our underlying good qualities. And realizing emptiness, the wisdom realizing emptiness is the ultimate nature of reality. That's the thing we have to work towards. So let's dedicate this stretch, this mental stretch that we've done tonight. Take a nice deep breath in through your nose, out through your mouth. And feel really good that you've made the effort. And let everything that we've contemplated and discussed settle into your mind like a rainfall of light. All the words and concepts, let them just come to rest in your mind, that you can come back to later at your leisure. And dedicate all of your energy in the for the short term to be able to develop that habit. How at the moment am I interpreting myself? And in the long term, to realizing the developing the wisdom, realizing emptiness that finds the selflessness of I, that realization that liberates us from all of our problems and all of their causes. And that by doing this, we'll be able to perfectly help others as well. So thank you.